ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, I'm talking to Craig Rissinger in honor of Noirvember, as we look at our top three films noir.
I killed Dietrichson. Me, Walter Neff, insurance agent, 35 years old, unmarried, no visible scars. Until a while ago, that is. Yeah, I killed him. I killed him for money and for a woman. It all began last May. I was thinking about that dame upstairs and the way she had looked at me. And I wanted to see her again, close, without that silly staircase between us. How could I have known that murder can sometimes smell like honeysuckle?
Literally translated to mean black or dark film, film noir was coined by French critic Nino Frank in 1946. The term wouldn't gather steam until the 1970s, but film noir came to symbolize American films made in the post-war 1940s and 50s that emphasized a bleak and cynical attitude, unsurprising considering the time period and the events that preceded it. The requirements for a film noir are fluid, and not every film conforms exactly. Most noirs involve some type of gritty instigator, like a private detective, a beat cop, a boxer, who narrates their descent into crime or degradation. Many of these films focus on the role of luck or fate, how good people become morally bankrupt. At the heart is usually a girl, one encompassing all the sin and vice of reality, but who is so enticing you can't help falling prey to her scheme. You'd also find narratively convoluted plots with the use of extensive flashback. Aesthetically, films noir subscribe to low-key lighting, unbalanced compositions, with an emphasis on chiaroscuro lighting, how light and shadow are contrasted with each other. Many of the films of the period were considered B-pictures, with modest budgets, actors, and directors. The low investment, though, allowed directors, screenwriters, and cinematographers to explore the medium through unique camera angles, which is why a heavy dose of German expressionism permeates this genre. Though characters weren't allowed to get away with murder due to the code, their inherent badness allowed them to get away with risque actions and dialogue, so long as they paid with their lives by the end credits.
Come closer. I want to talk to you. I'm going to tell you an astounding story. The story of the Maltese Falcon. 600 years, the Falcon has carried the mystery of a fabulous wealth under its grotesque wings. I could tell you 1,000 tales of the men and women who have hunted this evil bird. But every story has the same ending. Murder. Listen to these incredible people, all consumed by their passionate greed for the Maltese Falcon.
What have you ever given me beside money? Have you ever given me any of your confidence, any of the truth? Haven't you tried to buy my loyalty with money and nothing else?
What else is there I can buy you with?
Influenced by a multitude of different sources, both culturally and literarily, to detail every single one would take way too long. But sticking to what's relevant, most of the popular film noir was inspired by American crime detective writers like Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and James M. Cain. Films inspired by some of their work include Mildred Pierce and The Postman Always Rings Twice. One of the most prolific writers during the noir heyday of the 1940s was Cornell Woolrich, whose works were turned into 13 films noir, including works like Black Angel, The Chase, and Fear in the Night.
Mildred. Mildred. A name gasped in the night. The one last word of a dying man. But one word that tells 1,000 stories of a woman who left her mark on every man she met.
Mildred had more to offer a man in a glance than most women give in a lifetime. Mildred knew what she wanted. It wasn't too particular how she got it. Mildred? Loving her was like shaking hands with the devil.
As already mentioned, the 1940s and 50s are considered noir's heyday. Critics have argued that the work of Fritz Lang in the 1930s actually signifies the advent of the genre, but these films are regarded as proto-noirs that hadn't settled on a style for what was still an unknown genre. The first true noir is considered to be 1940's Stranger on the Third Floor, directed by Boris Ingster. Unfortunately, it lost its home studio of RKO over $56,000 upon release. There were more B-level noirs made than A films, but the best-remembered ones included A-list talent, both in front of and behind the camera. John Huston made his mark with noirs like The Asphalt Jungle, starring then-unknown Marilyn Monroe, The Maltese Falcon, and Key Largo, both starring husband-wife duo Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Four of Hitchcock's films are labeled as noir, despite debate on that: Shadow of a Doubt, The Wrong Man, Notorious, and Strangers on a Train. Other prominent names include prolific noir director Fritz Lang, Hollywood rebel Orson Welles, and Jules Dassin.
Sir?
Oh, yeah, I'm looking for a good mystery on something off the beaten track like the Maltese Falcon.
Oh, that was a fascinating story. But here's one that has everything the Falcon had and more. It's Raymond Chandler's latest bestseller, The Big Sleep. And what a picture that'll make.
You mind if I look at it? Sometimes I wonder what strange fate brought me out of the storm to that house that stood alone in the shadows. As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story. But each had the same ending, murder. Every instinct warned me to beware that something more dangerous, more deadly than I'd ever known before was in that room. And suddenly...
I like that. I'd like more.
Today, I'm talking with Craig Risinger. Craig, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Perhaps it goes without saying that I'm a big movie buff. I actually am not all that well-versed in film noirs, but it's one of the things that I like. And other things that I sort of bring to the table here are I do a little bit of photography. I wouldn't say that I'm a good photographer, but I do a fair bit of still photography. So I'm always looking at the cinematography in movies.
One of the first things that you and I talked about just a couple of seconds ago is the definitions of film noir. There's aesthetic definition, and then there's a narrative definition, and the two seem very different. For you, in cobbling this list especially, what constitutes a film noir in your mind?
That's a very telling point, that there's the stylistic aspect and the narrative aspect. The stereotypical film noir in my mind is shot in black and white and makes heavy use of darkness, right? And I guess the sort of classic definition that I've heard is it's treating darkness not just as the negative space between light, but looking at how dark shapes can actually fill the screen and be interesting in their own right. That's probably the main stylistic thing. And then for the narrative side of a film noir, it seems like the essential characteristic of a noir is that they tend to be a mystery, and that it unravels over time and ends. In a lot of noirs, you only ever see what the main protagonist is aware of. But in some of them, you only see what Sam Spade sees. There are no scenes that are showing you stuff happening that Sam Spade is not there for. They tend to be very complicated plots with lots of characters. The protagonist is constantly trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Who are all these characters? What do each of them want? And what have each of them done? And what are they going to do? And who can I trust or not? And how do I play this game and get what I want out of this when I don't even know who all the players are and what it is that they're trying to get?
You summed up a lot of the basic tenets really well, because the aesthetic elements, you have that interplay of light and shadow, the chiaroscuro lighting that really is only accomplished with black and white, you know, the dust motes through Venetian blinds. I tend to be more of a narrative person. It doesn't have to conform to a strict code. It's almost like the Supreme Court definition of pornography. I know it when I see it. Because for me, a noir is one of those where, yes, it can have the PI who tells it in voiceover, but I've always been a fan of the noirs where it's morally ambiguous character drawn into the moral decay of America, which ties into what noir started out as, which was a response to post-World War II as the French side. So you saw a lot of this suburban underbelly, which a lot of the noirs I like are the ones where it's these beautiful, wealthy facades that have these dark secrets hidden within them, which again is very noirish. But yes, yeah. you mentioned the mystery that's usually so convoluted. You don't really know if you're able to make heads or tails of it. You just go along with it. You obviously have the femme fatale. So there's always a woman, whether she's bad by genetics or bad by circumstance. She's still not the right girl, quote unquote. I'm one of those that tends to look at the story overall, but you can't ignore some of the huge aesthetic signposts that start them off. For our main discussion, we are going to be looking at our top three film noirs pre-1975. We're going to look at each of our three in terms of whether it fits the noir paradigm as most people would know it or not. Since Craig is our guest this week, why don't you start us off with your number three?
I'll have to say, I picked my top three. If you ask me to choose among them, I'm not sure that I could say which I love best. Number three was Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. There are several different versions of it because when he shot the movie and edited the movie, the studio cut it down a lot and added some other scenes and wrote like a 50-page memo detailing the changes that he wanted to make. And in 1998, somebody tried to reconstruct that as well as they could. So that's the version that I watched. This actually, more than the other two that I've picked, fits that stylistic definition of there is darkness on the screen in lots and lots of shots, and it is equal to the light. The amount of darkness in this film is kind of remarkable. Not only do a lot of scenes take place at night, but a lot of them take place in rural areas. It's not just there are shadows on the street. You're out in the countryside, and it's night, and so the entire sky is black, just inky black. And a lot of the shots are shot from considerably below eye level and occasionally considerably above eye level. And the famous opening scene, they even use a crane for an uninterrupted 3-minute or longer shot that moves from high to low. And even if it's not tilted, if it's just shot from the ground looking up, like when the main character in Touch of Evil, played by Orson Welles, is corrupt police agent border town in Texas. The opening shot is his car arrives and fills the screen. And it's just the left third of the screen, the door opens, and he gets out. And the entire right two-thirds of the frame is his black car at night, just filling the screen. And the door opens, and Welles steps out, and he's well-lit, but the car is not. So he's clearly bright. And then as he gets out, the camera sort of gets up with him. And, of course, at this point, he was also well into his I like food phase. He's this physically imposing presence as well. The plot summary of the movie, there's a bombing in Mexico, and it's not clear whether there's a Mexican law enforcement agent played, I kid you not, by Charlton Heston.
It's not Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes, which, for people who have listened, that episode was just me talking about Charlton Heston being naked and how unnecessary it was. So by this time, he's got clothes on, which is always about it.
Unnecessary, but, you know, the guy's in shape. The opening scene itself is a very tight close-up on a kitchen timer that is attached to a bomb. Can't see the face of the person doing this, but you see his hand set the timer for 3 minutes. So we see there's a bomb, and we know that it's going to go off. This is the most efficient establishing shot in history. You were immediately wrapped up into this. The main tension in the movie is between Welles basically discredit Heston's character and Heston trying to prove that Welles' character is actually corrupt. It moves along at a pretty good clip. Visually, it's a real treat. They have a lot of great use of music in the film, but the performances, especially by Orson Welles, I would say Heston's fine. So it is kind of hard to look at him and think, yeah, you're a top Mexican lawman. There's some great lines in it.
This was a very tough top three for me because there are so many good films to discuss out there. So much like Craig said, this isn't really three that I think are really worth people's time and are really good and might not be the ones that are on everybody's list. So my number three is Out of the Past from 1947, directed by Jacques Tourneur, who you might know if you watch something like Cat People. It was remade in 1984, with Jeff Bridges is Against All Odds.
Against All Odds with the Phil Collins song?
Yes, yes.
Wow, that's amazing.
you know, you have that boom in the 80s, early 90s of 1940s, 1950s film noir remakes. They remade that stuff like The Postman Always Rings Twice with Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange. And usually I think the only differentiation between the two films was like there was more sex in it. Out of the Past tells the story of a guy named Jeff, played by Robert Mitchum. He's trying to live this simple life of leisure as a gas station attendant in a small town, but he gets roped into, through a series of machinations, back into getting involved with associate of his named Witt, played by Kirk Douglas, and Witt's girl Friday, or gun mall, Kathy, played by Jane Greer. And the movie is essentially built on a series of flashbacks. You're never really sure at what point in time is the past and which is the future, or at least what is the present. It all goes back to Jeff being the PI that Witt hires to bring Kathy back to him, and they end up falling in love, and it all is fun and games until Kathy betrays him. That's like the first half hour, and the rest of the movie just goes from there. But film noir in the 40s, because they were bound by the production code, you couldn't be overt, which is why I think the 80s remakes don't really have the same staying power, because in the 80s you could do all the sex. Whereas in the 40s, a lot of that sexuality has to be metaphorical or subtextual. And Out of the Past is probably one of the, not there with like Double Indemnity, which Out of the Past I consider one of the sexiest noirs. And it's not because of Robert Mitchum, who is fantastic, and Jane Greer, who is utterly gorgeous, but there are moments where Jeff and Kathy come in from the rain and they're cowling each other off, and then the camera just goes to the open door for no reason, just kind of holds there for a beat, and then Jeff comes back and closes it, and you're supposed to have assumed that time has passed and that these two have had sex with each other. So it's sly little things like that that made these movies sexy without having to show the sex. Notorious is also a really good example of that, too. But the movie just builds on Jane Greer's character. And Jane Greer, I mean, she's got these big doe eyes, and she is evil incarnate. There's a scene where Robert Mitchum is fighting with a guy, and you're just looking at the shadows on the wall, and she's standing there with a gun in her hand, just reveling in it, that these two guys are fighting in front of her, and she's kind of intrigued by it. Kirk Douglas, always great, a smarmy bad guy. Robert Mitchum, this is the movie where he gets that famous line, "Baby, I don't care," which is what he called his autobiography. So it's a really great little noir that doesn't have a ton of intrigue. It doesn't have this all-star cast that something like The Big Sleep has, but at the same time, aesthetically, it totally has that black and white lighting. It's got the PI character, but there's just that added veneer of sexuality to it, especially at the end, which took me a couple of times to realize the ending is two people in a car and they're driving and somebody gets shot in a very uncomfortable place, and you don't really notice it until second or third time you watch it, and you're like, oh, that's Freudian right there. It's a very deeply complex noir that I think just gets better with time. When I first saw it, I didn't really care for it, and the more I've seen it, the more it just sticks in your brain, and you just think there's something here.
Those complicated plots, like Miller's Crossing.
Very much so. You Coen brothers, I mean, they love noir. Can see the little influences that they cherry-pick from the era.
First time I watched The Big Lebowski.
There's actually a lot of criticism written about how The Big Lebowski falls into the category of neo-noir, which is that resurgence of late 90s, early 2000s movies that have those noir aesthetics. Craig, what is your number two?
My number two is The Third Man, 1946 or so, directed by Carol Reed. I didn't realize until I was watching these again that two out of my three films, I picked films where Orson Welles plays a charismatic villain.
You'll actually see him in my honorable mention, so do not feel bad.
I think Orson Welles is one of the most astonishingly charismatic people to ever grace film. His last movie, F for Fake, I literally got off my seat to stand closer to the TV as he was telling a story to the camera. He's just incredibly magnetic. People said Audrey Hepburn, you could just film her eating an apple and that's your movie. And I feel the same way about Orson Welles. Like, just, you can't take your eyes off the guy. There's something amazing about him. And in The Third Man, they do a neat little trick here where even though he sort of is the main character, you don't see him for like 50 minutes or so into the movie, because the plot is that the Joseph Cotton character plays a Western author who is friends with the character played by Orson Welles, whose name is Harry Lime, and he accepts Lime's invitation to come visit him in Vienna, Austria, in just after World War II. So he goes there to visit him and immediately finds out that Lime has just been killed in an accident on the street. Throughout the movie, he is trying to figure out what happened, and he goes around and interviews the various survivors, talks to the landlord, and he's the first guy who tells him, no, you just missed him. He's just gone to the cemetery. Like, wait, what? Meets the friends one at a time and teases out who else is there. Over the course of the first half of the movie, he comes to realize that it's possible that it wasn't an accident. It's possible that it was murder. And then we find out, spoiler alert, that Lime is still alive. And the reveal for that is a great little bit of cinematography, because they establish Cotton is having a conversation with Harry Lime's girlfriend in her house, and she's got a cat, and she says, oh yeah, that cat doesn't like anyone except for Harry. Harry's the only one that cat ever likes. And so the cat leaves the building. At some point, the camera follows the cat, and it goes up to a dark doorway. There's a wonderfully, artfully done roof. They still spin out the mystery here if you're trying to chase him and find him, and now, holy cow, he's alive, but how do I get in touch with him? And as with the typical noir, the plot's fairly complicated. It's very serious. The Joseph Cotton character, he's the protagonist, except the one you actually care about is Harry Lime. This is another movie that has really great cinematography. I think somebody said this was the first movie where somebody in Hollywood decided to spray water on the streets when you're photographing them at night so that they look better. There are just a tremendous number of shots of the city of Vienna at night. It was beautifully done. Where Touch of Evil had just absolutely inky black everywhere, there's actually not that much. There's a lot of shadows that you can still kind of see into. But in Touch of Evil, it's more like the light source is something that you notice, because there are bright lights in the city and everything is sort of else in contrast to that. They say that one thing that people like about movies and TV shows is when they take you somewhere else that you don't normally get to go. So here you really do get to see Vienna. I assume it was shot on location. It surely looks like it. You really feel like you're in Vienna in 1946 or so, and you see how everything's been bombed out, but you've still got a lot of the old buildings are still standing, and the architecture is beautiful. All the cinematography is really great as well. You have a great sense of place and time, and then introduces these characters who are all very interesting little in their own right. I really liked the main English cop who's trying to chase down Harry Lime. He tells Holly Martin, your friend Mr. Lime, he's not as good as you think he is. He's really a criminal. He's working in the black market here. He is just a really charming cop. Stereotype of English policing of they don't take any guff, but they're very polite and very nice about it. There is a lot of German spoken in this movie that does not have subtitles. Works if you don't speak German, of course, because it puts you in the perspective of the main character, the Joseph Cotton character, who doesn't speak that much German either, so he doesn't really know what's going on. Of course, if you do speak German, then it adds a nice little extra bit there.
Definitely playing to post-World War II audience. That's another one I haven't seen. You know, I'm starting to think I used to avoid Orson Welles' movies. My number two is going from the streets to the glittering exotic locales. It's 1946's Gilda. Gilda is another one of those movies that has just stuck with me throughout the years. It tells of small-time gambler Johnny Farrell, played by Glenn Ford, who goes to Argentina and becomes the right-hand man to this wealthy guy, Balin Munson, played by George McCready, who is married to a woman named Gilda, played by Rita Hayworth. And you find out that Gilda and Johnny were once lovers that ended badly, and this is a great movie in terms of blending both noir with like a domestic drama, because much of the movie, again, talk about sexiness of out of the past. This is essentially about two people who were once together, have parted, and as much as they hate each other, you start to think that hatred is just lust that's been fueled between the two of them for all these years, because Balin is a feminine sophisticate who has this whole secret network of corruption, and Johnny himself is a small-time dice player. The movie start with the camera down on the ground watching him shoot dice. So you're much like Johnny down in the dirt with the average guys. And Johnny's very seduced by Fallon's life, which is opulent, and it's casinos and five-star restaurants, and he's got Gilda. The movie is a social climber's story, watching Johnny try to climb the ladder to become Fallon. And of course, what happens when the husband ends up dying and Johnny doesn't trust Gilda. The third act is a very bizarre film from where it starts, but it's all about Rita Hayworth. This is the movie that brought her into prominence with nothing but a flip of the hair and the word me. If you've seen Shawshank Redemption, they include the clip where we're introduced to Rita Hayworth as she's changing and Fallon asks her if she's decent, which, as the movie tells us, she's not. But really, she is. Because Rita Hayworth, I think, always was adept at playing that woman who was very exotic and you thought was bad girl, but really she just wants simple things in life that she can't get, which again is the third act of this movie. And Gilda, according to her, ruined her life because she famously said that men went to bed expecting Gilda and woke up with her. But at the same time, it's impossible not to be drawn in by her because she's beautiful for starters, but she's a woman who wants what she wants, and she's been under the control of her husband, she's been under the control of Johnny, and she doesn't want that anymore, but at the same time, she's stuck realizing that it's a man's world, and she doesn't have a lot of options. And again, you get that smoky cigarette look, case that just kind of hangs in all the scenes. The noirs, for me, that I love are the ones that show, again, the opulence and that seedy underbelly. So even though Johnny's traversing these fine Argentinian casinos, there's a lot of backdoor shenanigans and gambling and corruption and, of course, the mental deterioration of a woman that they're secretly gaslighting throughout the entire movie. If you haven't seen Gilda and you've just kind of seen like the put the blame on Mame number, you're really missing out on a great noir that takes the gritty domestic elements of noir and traverses them to this exotic foreign locale where everything should be better, but it's actually, you know, the worst elements are just flaunted more in the open.
When you said that for you, one of the elements of a noir is that it shows the seamy underbelly and that things are not as nice as they might seem on the surface, I actually immediately thought of David Lynch with Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet.
Well, what is your next one?
My number one, and I have to say that this is definitely the one I've watched most often out of the ones that I've listed, is The Maltese Falcon. It is, I swear, I saw this movie 4 or 5 times in 1 year, plus I read the Dashiell Hammett novel, plus I listened to an audiobook recording of it that's a staged audiobook with Michael Madsen and Sandra Oh. It's really well done. I recommend consuming this in all of these forms. The movie's great, the audiobook's great, the book is great. It is really engaging on a moment-to-moment basis. There is a lot of plot. Compared to The Thin Man and Touch of Evil, I'd say The Maltese Falcon has the least impressive cinematography, or it's certainly the least flashy cinematography, but it's still really good. There's a lot of subtle camera motion where the camera is tracking Sam Spade as he walks around the car to get back in, but it's not as remarkable in your face cinematography that you get in Thin Man or Touch of Evil. The Maltese Falcon is all about characters confronting each other. And the Sam Spade character, played by Humphrey Bogart, in Touch of Evil, you have the protagonist in every scene. There were scenes where you would see things happening with other characters. And in Maltese Falcon, I'm pretty sure that every scene has Sam Spade in it. So it's all from his perspective of femme fatale enters and we've got a nice quick setup. 7 minutes in, there's the first murder. In 12 minutes, we've had another murder, although it's off screen. So this is just moving along, bang, bang, bang. It's a great role for Humphrey Bogart. The character's great. He plays him wonderfully. There's great confrontation with police agents who are vicious of Spade. The key things of the noir, right, is that the protagonist doesn't even necessarily want to get involved in this complicated brouhaha, right, this crazy plot. But he gets drawn in, and he realizes that he's going to be in trouble unless he can figure out what's going on and give it to the police and therefore make himself innocent. It's probably the easiest to like of all these movies, and it's certainly the one that I've seen the most. It's incredibly likable. You've got this great Dashiell Hammett dialogue. The police confront aide, and they say, you know, we think you shot him. And he goes, how'd I kill him? I forget. He talks to his secretary later, and he's like, well, the cops think I shot Miles. She thinks I shot Miles. The cops think I killed Thursby. Who do you think I shot? Lots of nice little lines like that. You paid us more than if you'd been telling us the truth, and enough more to make it all right. Wonderful stuff. Everyone else is really great. And Mary Astor does a good job. I realized that I didn't like some of her acting. It seemed a little bit fake. And then I realized, well, the character she's playing is herself lying. The unsung star of the movie for me is Peter Lorre. He is just absolutely delightful in all of his scenes. And I've seen him in three movies or so, and he's just been absolutely wonderful in all of them. They have a nice little joke when he first gets to meet Sam Spade. I won't ruin it, but they have a nice little expectation being subverted there. Sidney Greenstreet, who was also Greenstreet, Bogart, and Lorre were all in Casablanca together, too. They played nicely together here as well. I'm still not entirely sure that I follow the plot, despite having watched and read it so many times.
There's a falcon. That's all you need, I think.
Yeah, the way that happens, too, late in the movie, there's a scene where he sees a name circled in a newspaper of the ship where he thinks the falcon is. And then they immediately cut to that ship on fire. And like, Jesus, there's a lot of stuff happens in this movie. And it's just a pleasure to watch the whole way through. Dashiell Hammett had actually been a private detective for a while, so he gets some of the details a little bit right.
The Maltese Falcon is quintessential film noir. You have the MacGuffin, which is the Falcon itself, even though they tell us it's the stuff dreams are made of. The movie's got far more going than actually them tracking down a falcon, which is why the plot is so difficult to follow. But that is the prime example. That's Noir 101 there. So I'm glad to see it made up the list.
I'm not going to win any awards for originality on that one.
Nothing wrong with that.
Great. I love it.
So my number one, when I said not every noir has to be black and white, there are a few in color. My number one is probably the most beautiful, gorgeously technicolor noirs out there. It's 1945's Leave Her to Heaven. Leave Her to Heaven is one of my favorite movies, directed by John Stahl with some great, I think it's Leon Shamroy, technicolor cinematography, but it tells of a guy named Richard Harlan, played by Cornell Wilde, who meets a woman named Ellen Berent, played by Jean Tierney, on the train. She's conveniently reading, I think, the book he wrote. And, of course, this relationship blossoms from there, this chance encounter, until they get to her family's house, which is this huge estate, and her family tells him whatever Ellen wants, Ellen gets. Her problem is that she loves too much. From there, they get married very quickly, and things start happening. He brings his handicapped brother to stay with them in their house. And Ellen doesn't really like that. She has a very kind, sweet sister played by Jean Crane, who, for all of Ellen's glamour and elegance, she pops out of a swimming pool with a full face of makeup on, wakes up the next morning with a full face of makeup on. Jean Crane's character is gardening or, you know, retiling the roof. You know, she's this weird guy's girl. But, of course, bodies start piling up, and the third act is remarkable for how it ends up playing out. This is a great example of noir in blistering color because it's an average Joe, Cornell Wilde's character, drawn into these horrific circumstances that he could have never foreseen by the Wheel of Fate, which is another noir element. They're drawn to this by circumstance or by luck or something. And Jean Tierney's character, first of all, she's rendered beautifully, blood red lipstick, big sunglasses. She is evil incarnate, but she is so glamorous about it. You just can't help but be seduced by her. And at the same time, I've always argued that Leave Her to Heaven is a post-war look at what the women, we told women to go back home after the war, and this is what they've become. They've become these fiercely independent, murderous man manipulators. But at the same time, I'm not feeling too bad for Cornell Wilde in this movie because he marries her and then immediately says, let's move my prepubescent brother into this house with us. And there's a scene where they're sleeping in two separate beds, husband and wife, because again, it's 45. And he gets into the bed with him and tries to start canoodling. And Cornell Wilde wakes up and says, hey, isn't it great that my brother's in the next room? And he starts hitting the wall. And him and the brother have this like back and forth. I'm watching this movie thinking, she's a newlywed. This guy don't want to do anything with her but hang out with his brother. Suspect a little something here, Cornell. I don't know what's going on. it's all about Gene Tierney. I know I could have put Laura on here, which is an honorable mention that we'll touch on later, but I think she's just so cool and calm, but you can see the rationality in her character. She believes that what he's doing is to keep him from straying. That's a very valid fear that women, you know, or anybody in a relationship can have if there's not trust established. Do I think that some of the things she does, wearing a beautiful nightgown with a full face of makeup before she throws herself down the stairs to get rid of the unborn child that they're going to have? Oh, that's a little extreme. At the same time, you find out that she is so wrapped up in him and doesn't want anyone to share love with him, even if it's their child together. And you compare this to something like Gilda, which is all about male control of the femme fatale. And this is the femme fatale screams back. And I love it. It's beautiful. If you have not seen it, just get wrapped up in it. It is fantastic. Actually, when I went to the TCM Film Festival last year, I got to talk to Daryl Hickman, who plays the younger brother in this movie. I mean, he said that filming that swimming scene was very, very hard for him because they had to film it a couple of times, and that Gene Tierney wasn't exactly the most friendly woman in the world, but that she was beautiful. You couldn't really ignore that. Definitely watch it. The most beautiful looking noir in the world because it's in color, but at the same time, it has all these dark and gritty elements that I think it makes it even grittier than some of the black and white noirs. It's fantastic.
Like Blue Velvet, right? Filmed in these lush, saturated colors.
Exactly. I was also going to throw out something like, not The Aviator, but something like Far From Heaven, Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, which again, very rich technicolor of these kind of beautiful, expansive locales. It's fantastic. So let's throw out just real briefly some films that almost made the list that didn't. I'll throw out mine because I have a couple here. The Big Sleep from 1946 with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. It's an incredibly confusing movie that I still don't think I know the plot to, but they're amazing. Martha Vickers is amazing as the little sister who presumably had more scenes but was so good that they cut them out. I also would say Laura from 1944, a very dreamy noir about Gene Tierney's character who is supposedly murdered, or is she? Speaking of Orson Welles, The Lady from Shanghai from 1947, that's Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth, the movie they made together, that they say destroyed Rita Hayworth's career because Orson Welles demanded that she cut her hair and dye it blonde. But it's filmed in San Francisco in 47, which I live 2 hours away from there, so I love seeing what it looked like during that time. There's a beautiful noirish moment where they're at the Steinhardt Aquarium, San Francisco, before they built it, and it's the creepiest sequence that takes place in front of a wall full of fish. There's also a funhouse scene at the end that's fantastic. Night of the Hunter from 1955, which a lot of people don't consider noir, but I think some of the imagery is very evocative of the genre.
Very much so. That's another movie that's just beautiful black and white cinematography with lots of dark and light interplay.
And Double Indemnity from 1944. It's a classic. I think Fred McMurray saying baby at the end of every sentence is a little over the top. But it's quintessential noir. You cannot not discuss it in a film noir list. Craig, what almost made the list for you?
I don't have a big list of runner-ups here, but I would actually have to say The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick movie.
Yes.
Second movie, which you have already done an episode on with my friend Jake. I think it's got, again, Kubrick, so it's wonderful cinematography. I forget. I think Steven Spielberg said you could put on any Kubrick movie, stop at any random frame and just print it out as a picture. Guy had a great, great eye. The main actor in The Killing.
Oh, Sterling Hayden.
Sterling Hayden. He's great. He's like doing method acting that he just sort of discovered on his own, I think, because he's so much more believable in every role he does than most of the other people with him in the 1950s. He's doing naturalistic acting. And it's also got Elisha Cook Jr., who was the gunman for Mr. Gutman in Maltese Falcon.
That's right. He is in there.
Like, he and Peter Lorre and some of these other supporting characters are really just knocking it out of the park. Killing's a really great one. I mentioned Double Indemnity. Stanley Kubrick's first movie, this is definitely second tier noir and at least second tier for Kubrick, but his first movie is called Killer's Kiss, which is actually available if you get the Criterion edition of The Killing. They include the entire movie of Killer's Kiss as a bonus feature, which is a pretty amazing deal. It's also one of Criterion's cheaper ones, too. So you get two Kubrick films with the Criterion treatment for the price of one, which is pretty good. It follows a boxer and the dame who enters his life. And I even forget most of the plot here, but the shots of the boxing match where the camera like gets in tight and is moving around, and it makes you feel like you're in the ring with him. Then the seamy underbelly of the cheap dime for a dance halls, and some beautiful shots of the city at night. There's some great foot chases there. There's a scene where one guy is fleeing another guy, and it goes to a shot on the roof, and there's this huge expanse of roof, and the camera is just perfectly steady, and you see a tiny little dot come out far away in the screen and run all the way toward you and circles all the way around and then realizes that there's no way out and then goes back. There's some great cinematography like that, or there's a fight that takes place in a mannequin storage unit.
You gotta love all the inventive places noir films thought to film.
And there's this mannequin storage unit, and you see these substitute bodies just destroyed. The weak part of all this is the lead actor in particular, he's pretty terrible. So the acting's not so great, some of the writing's not so great, but it's still kind of worth watching, especially if you are a Kubrick completist or you like interesting visuals. And if we didn't have to do 70s and earlier, I would say Miller's Crossing. It's film noir in the extremely complicated plot, although not in the visual style at all, and likewise Big Lebowski.
If we're going to throw out post the purview of the podcast, I got to throw out LA Confidential as well, which is,
yes.
I think it bridges the gap, actually, of being a neo-noir that actually harkens back in both aesthetic and time period, because it is set during, I think, the 50s as well. Absolutely. With a bunch of references to classic film stars, and Kim Basinger plays a Veronica Lake lookalike. When everybody asks me how I feel, knowing that I'm a huge Veronica Lake fan, how I feel about her performance, and say, well, she performs very well, but she's a Veronica Lake lookalike because she sure doesn't look like Veronica Lake. She's too tall. Veronica Lake is very small.
That's a great one. One other one, too, the neo-noir's Brick by Ryan Johnson. Fantastic movie.
Yeah, Brick and The Lookout, I also think, is another good Joseph Gordon-Levitt set noir throwback as well. Well, let me know what your favorite noirs are. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'm going to read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank Craig once again for joining me today, especially during the week of Thanksgiving. Once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you, Craig?
They probably can't. Go back and listen to the Killing episode, and it's my friend Jake who's the guest on that episode, and you should be checking him out anyway because he's a really funny and talented musician anyhow. So if you really do want to get in touch with me, mail Jake. And while you're at it, check out his music.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter now at ticklish_biz. And if you enjoy my work on the show or my website, consider supporting me on Patreon. Patrons can get access to early episodes, pick the movies or themes I review, even guest on a future episode. So if you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbusiness. Next week is our first Ticklish Business Christmas episode, but the movie choice is actually going to be in your hands. So head over to my Twitter page and cast your vote for one of the following films: 1944's Meet Me in St. Louis, 1945's Christmas in Connecticut, or 1947's The Bishop's Wife. Till next time!